From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The American right wing has enjoyed one success after another in chipping away at women's legal right to an abortion. The decision by Donald Trump's administration to withhold Title X funding for family planning from providers that also offer abortion is only one prong of a multi-prong effort. Other efforts include a steady stream of statewide bans on abortion at earlier and earlier stages of a pregnancy, including when a pregnancy is first confirmed through an ultrasound. How did we, in this modern day age, come to a point where women's bodies are still being legislated? Telling the story of how the right has planned to destroy legal abortion is my guest, Jessica Mason Piclo. She's the Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news and a writer and adjunct professor in Boulder, Colorado, and the former Assistant Director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamlin Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's also a former litigator, and she's a co-author of a new book with Robin Marty called The End of Roe, Inside the Right's Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So your book is sort of comprehensive and therefore quite terrifying when all put together. On this program, of course, every time there's news around the new state that is trying to ban abortion, we cover it as a news story. Putting it all together reveals a very sinister and very nefarious plan. Let's start with what it was that you felt, especially with the latest round of what the Trump administration has done around Title X funding. How successful has this movement been so far?
I think what we're seeing this year, in particular with the Trump administration, is the culmination of at least a decade's worth of intense advocacy in state houses and in the federal courts by the anti-choice movement. And you point to one very recent victory of the Trump administration successfully getting Planned Parenthood and other reproductive health care providers to withdraw from the Title X family planning program because of restrictions around information and services that they can provide patients. But you mentioned in the introduction things like state level abortion bans that feel like they're kind of coming out of nowhere. But what Robin and I were really able to do in this book is lay out the fact that this is a strategy that is multi-prong and has been underway for some time. And what we are seeing and feeling now are many of those pressure points coming to be.
Let's go to Nebraska, which is where you open your book, where it all started. What role does Nebraska play in this long-term plan?
Nebraska is very important in the efforts to roll back reproductive choice because it is the launching point of the fight against the so-called partial birth abortion ban. And Nebraska had a state-level ban that ultimately was challenged and went up to the Supreme Court and was found unconstitutional. And between that time and the time that a nearly identical ban happened in the Supreme Court, we saw a pivot politically. And so Nebraska opens the book because from the fight over the so-called partial birth abortion ban in Nebraska, we get this U.S. Supreme Court decision in Gonzales v. Carhart. And that's a decision that, first of all, upholds the federal partial birth abortion ban as constitutional. It's the first time we get a Supreme Court decision upholding a pre-viability abortion ban. And so that's very significant. It's also significant because of the rationale that the court uses and the test that it sets forth, which is what we are seeing play out in the courts now today with these very radical extreme abortion bans. And in the Gonzales decision, what the court says effectively is if there are matters of scientific dispute, state lawmakers are free to choose a side so long as it appears that they have done so fairly by conducting hearings and releasing legislative findings of fact. And so that becomes the open door from which the anti-choice movement starts to flood state houses and federal courts with junk science in their effort to get more and more extreme abortion bans in place and ultimately upheld. And we are seeing that fight very much play out in the states right now.
The ultimate plan with these state-by-state bills is, of course, to get the Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade, right? Because as far as I understand, the so-called fetal heartbeat bans, and that title is also a very politicized title, not really based in science. But as far as I understand, none of them have been implemented yet because all of them are facing legal challenge because all of them violate Supreme Court precedents with Roe versus Wade, right?
Absolutely. They are patently unconstitutional. There is not a way to resurrect these bans and make them constitutional. And so far, not a single federal court has allowed them to take effect. And that is good. The courts are doing their job. And it's not just that they are unconstitutional because Roe says that states can't ban abortion before viability. They are also very cynical because in their attempts to strike at Roe, they're attempting to do things like redefine what viability means in the law. And these are medical standards. And the
viability impact, as in the viability of a pregnancy to come to term, mm-hmm. of a fetus to become mm-hmm. a person.
Exactly. The law has defined where states' interests start to increase when it comes to restricting abortion at the point of fetal viability. And fetal viability is important because that is a much later stage in pregnancy. What these extreme abortion bans are doing is trying to take that legal concept, which is also a medical concept, and pervert it into complete something that is meaningless so that, quote unquote, fetal viability now means detectable as soon as cardiac activity happens. But that's not even a fetus. Words have no meaning now in these bans. But
right, cardiac activity implies the existence of a heart.
Exactly, but what we have is a fetal pole. And so, you know, what Gonzalez really did in terms of was to open the door for this. And so now it's incumbent on federal courts and lawmakers to put a barrier up for anti-choice advocates here because they really feel, particularly with the Trump administration, as though it is all bets are off. They have a complete green light to go and pass whatever ban they want and make whatever argument they want because they feel like they have enough sympathetic judges in the federal court and ultimately the Supreme Court.
So in addition to the long-term plan of getting the Supreme Court to consider this, it's critical for the right to have a majority on the Supreme Court that will overturn Roe versus Wade. I mean, you have to admire their tenacity, their doggedness, their determination with President Donald Trump. Two Supreme Court justices were replaced, both of whom were, you know, arguably anti-abortion. Definitely Neil Gorsuch. Brett Kavanaugh has managed to convince, you know, some senators among the Republican Party that he's not entirely anti-abortion, but that seems to be not true. So is that also part of this plan?
Absolutely. Capture of the federal courts, specifically the Supreme Court, is tantamount to this strategy. And we saw that during the Obama administration and the stolen seat of Merrick Garland that led to President Trump being able to appoint Neil Gorsuch. But really, it's the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy that provided the real opportunity for the anti-choice community here, because although Anthony Kennedy was not what I would call a friend to abortion rights, I mean, he gave us the decision in Gonzales v. Carhart that I just was telling you about how terrible it is. And in that decision made up things like abortion regret syndrome and was very clearly not a man who supported abortion rights. He was unwilling, at least throughout most of his career, to go so far as to strike at the heart of the idea that people are entitled to reproductive autonomy. And so far, it looks as though his replacement, Brett Kavanaugh, does not have those qualms.
There have been a lot of losses for the pro-choice movement. There have been some victories as well. Among them, you write about the Supreme Court decision in Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. Tell us about that decision and what it indicates for the fight.
So Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt is significant for a couple reasons. One, it was an important victory just to have a win for abortion rights in the Supreme Court after years and years and years of feeling like it was loss after loss after loss, and particularly at a time when it was also feeling very hostile in the states. And the decision is extremely important because what it did was take that idea that I had just mentioned in Gonzalez about states being able to effectively pick sides when they're legislating in certain areas and say, fine, states, you can pick a side, but you still have to have evidence to back up your conclusion that your particular restriction is going to, say, advance patient safety. And that is extremely important because up to this point, up to the point of Whole Woman's Health, lawmakers, as we saw in Texas, were effectively saying, basically, trust me, I promise that this restriction is going to advance patient safety, when in reality, all they were trying to do was close abortion clinics and make it harder to access care. And there's fundamentally no way that that improves patient safety.
Right. So this idea that abortion clinics had to operate within a certain distance of a hospital or get admitting privileges was the sort of tangential stealth attack on abortion clinics. And this particular Supreme Court decision exposed that.
Exactly. And it was effective in doing so because one of the tools that the anti-choice movement has used to attack abortion access is weaponizing the regulatory state and creating what we call trap regulations, targeted restrictions on abortion providers. And they are things like the restrictions that you just mentioned that were at issue in Texas, requiring certain architectural requirements for abortion clinics, requiring detailed licensure requirements that other similar facilities don't have to undergo, patient reporting requirements, all sorts of things that are designed to burden the practice of medicine to the point that you don't want to do it.
Speaking of the issue of medicine, how has the anti-abortion movement, the anti-choice movement, impacted the relationship between doctors and patients? This is not an aspect that gets talked about very much. And all of the right-wing furor over the Affordable Care Act and this idea that bureaucrats were getting between doctors and patients, no one talks about how the anti-abortion movement has essentially done the same thing, if not worse.
Oh, absolutely. And it has done so in several ways. So you mentioned at the start of our segment the attacks on Title X family planning program. Mm-hmm. Some of those restrictions include a prohibition on providers referring patients for abortion care, even if they don't provide abortion care themselves. That right there is a direct interference with the provider-patient relationship. That is impeding someone's ability to provide comprehensive reproductive health care to a patient. So that is one immediate example. And we see that play out in abortion restrictions consistently. There are state-mandated scripts that doctors must tell patients that they have a higher risk of breast cancer, which is not medically true, for example. Mandatory ultrasounds.
A higher risk of breast cancer if they get abortion.
In an abortion, correct. Describing in mandatory ultrasounds, describing the image on the screen, regardless if the patient wants it, to even, I'd say, the rise and prevalence of Catholic hospitals throughout this country. The role that the Catholic healthcare system plays in impeding access to comprehensive reproductive health care is a critical one. And if you are in many places across the country, your only option is to go to a Catholic hospital. And then there are directives in place that would prioritize the life of your developing pregnancy over your own in certain medical indications.
What about access to medications that can help induce abortions, but even medications such as Plan B, the so-called morning after pill, and just regular birth control? All of those have been attacked by the anti-abortionists as well, right?
Right. There really is no limiting principle here when you talk about the attacks on reproductive autonomy, because they are not intent to just stop with abortion. They will be coming and are coming after contraception as well. That is what, in fact, the Title X restrictions are really designed to do, is make it harder to get contraception. But you mentioned medication abortion. We've seen in states very successful attempts to curb back the use of telemedicine, for example, in prescribing medication abortion. Now you can take, you know, people can very effectively and safely self-administer medication to induce an abortion. And we allow this practice in a lot of other areas of medicine, but because of anti-abortion animus, it has been targeted. And this is an impact that is devastating in rural communities, especially where you are traveling sometimes hours to clinics.
So the place that we're at right now and where you wrote your book in terms of the long-term goal to overturn Roe versus Wade, is the line right now being held by a single person named Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Are we seeing, you know, a lot of people realizing that the Supreme Court, of course, is going to be where this other Supreme Court, this earlier Supreme Court decision will be overturned? And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the oldest member of the court, you know, who is a very strong pro-choice figure, is, you know, if anything were to happen to her between now and the next year, if and when Trump is removed from power, it could be the end.
It could be devastating. I mean, you know, Justice Ginsburg has without a doubt been a very clear voice for the importance of reproductive autonomy. I think also the reality is a lot of this is in Chief Justice John Roberts' hands. He is, for all intents and purposes, the swing vote now on the court.
The new Kennedy.
Yeah, and that is not a great place for abortion rights to be, frankly. And so, but that also, I think, hopefully sparks some other conversations, because it is not enough for us to rely on the federal courts to be a firewall for our human rights. We need to have more and do more. And so we're seeing states, for example, start to pick up and take the lead on that in certain areas. I mean, even you have the state of Kansas, for example, its Supreme Court had come down with a decision that said, you know, abortion is a fundamental right under its state constitution. So ultimately, whatever happens at the Supreme Court, this will be an ongoing conversation. And I think that now is a good time as any for us as advocates and journalists and people invested in this issue to say, you know, what is our plan? Not just how will we make abortion accessible should the Supreme Court recriminalize it, but what is the legal framework that we are going to push to get reproductive autonomy fully recognized in the American jurisprudential system?
In some ways, it seems as though we are not quite at the end of the line, but in other ways, the opposite seems true. I'm thinking about stories that emerge from other countries, such as in Latin America, where we recently heard of one woman who was facing a 30-year sentence for a stillbirth. That conviction was overturned, but it was a tremendous amount of work. She had been raped, she got pregnant, and then the pregnancy ended on its own, but she was held responsible. And we sort of sometimes might look at a story like that thinking, wow, if we don't protect our right to abortion or just change the conversation around women's bodies and our autonomy, we could end up there. But then we have stories like Purvi Patel's and Bebe Schwai in Indiana, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You mentioned two women who were both prosecuted for their pregnancy outcome. And I'd add another woman to that list too, Samantha Flute, who's a Native American woman out of South Dakota. I recently reported on a decision from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that was a split decision with a Trump appointee, David Strauss, providing the deciding vote that allows the federal government to prosecute Ms. Flute for the death of her newborn as a result of what they believe were alleged acts in utero. They claim she ingested certain substances that caused the death of her newborn hours after death. And this is the first time we've seen the federal government try to prosecute a woman for a pregnancy outcome. And so this is terrifying. So I agree with you. It's on the one hand, we want to hesitate and make comparisons from the United States to other countries. But at the other time, I think we have to have a very honest conversation about the fact that that is happening here and also to whom it's happening.
It's women. There was a recent poll that found a strong overlap between people's general attitudes towards women and their propensity to be against abortion. Those interesting poll that was done that, you know, questioned people's position on abortion, but then asked them a whole host of questions about just women's rights in general, and found the strong overlap between those who don't feel women can be trusted with their own bodies and who support abortion. And at the same time, we still live in a country where a majority support a woman's right to access abortion, don't we? I mean, that's a critically important fact.
It is a critically important fact. And I think the distinguishing item right there is the misogyny. I mean, that poll really lays it clear that the distrust for women is the driver in the increase in support for abortion restrictions and other types of restrictions. And so when you take the sort of grand number of the fact that most people support in this country support abortion rights, I would assume that that includes most women who are also understanding that we can be trusted best with our own choices, you know, despite the fact that it was white women voters who put Trump in office. So there is a lot of disconnect when it comes to this country and abortion politics.
What would you like to see as someone who's followed these stories in terms of the best case scenario for reversing this rightward trend toward ending Roe versus Wade? A lot of people, you know, groups like Planned Parenthood would say support Planned Parenthood now that they can't access that federal funding for Title X family planning. They are having to fundraise directly from people. But aside from personally, financially supporting groups like Planned Parenthood, what do you think needs to happen?
Well, first of all, everybody needs to remember and be reminded that abortion is still legal in all 50 states in this country and remains so. As one of the unfortunate effects of all of these abortion restrictions, whether or not they pass, is that they sow confusion and terror in people. And so you still have the right to seek care if that's what you need. But what I would love to see happen, frankly, is a way to move this conversation out of the courts. Because we should not be relying on appointed judges to recognize what is fundamental human rights. And so that requires a significant political will. And that is my ultimate, you know, sort of wish list, is to get this beyond the battle of a partisan Supreme Court or a split Congress over whether or not we're going to pass something. That could be a passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, for example. So there are ways to rally around that. But ultimately, I do think that the conversation needs to go beyond a Roe framework in this country. And that is a difficult conversation to have.
Well, Jessica, hopefully your book will help towards starting that conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Jessica Mason Piclo, Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news. And we've been discussing the new book that she's just co-authored with Robin Marty called The End of Roe versus Wade, Inside the Rights Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.